Today at Reader's Corner, Robert W. Mary, author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. 228 years ago this April, George Washington took the oath of office as the first president of the United States. Since then, 44 Americans have taken that solemn vow, most recently Donald Trump just a month ago. History is yet to judge our most recent presidents, but as we look farther into the past, we can ask which presidents have stood the test of time and are revered today, and which ones are now viewed as less successful or even as failures. On this President's Day weekend, we're discussing presidential performance with today's guest, Robert W. Mary. He is the author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. It's now out in paperback. Robert Mary is the editor of the American Conservative magazine and the author of several previous books, including A Country of Vast Designs, a biography of President Polk. His latest book, A Biography of President William McKinley, will be released in September. Mr. Mary covered the White House, Congress, and national politics for the Wall Street Journal and spent 22 years as an executive at the Congressional Quarterly, including 12 years as CEO. He also is a former editor of the National Interest. Mr. Mary joins us today by phone for this interview. Bob Mary, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being with you.
Well, I'll tell you, I would imagine there's all kinds of people picking up your book these days. I know it's only 1 month into the new presidency, but needless to say, everybody's trying to figure it out. And of course, we're all in the business of ranking presidents, whether we're in a political science classroom or a bar. And here you come along with this great White House rating game, but you start off with a prejudice. A good prejudice, that is. Something about the office of the presidency. Sum that up for us as we kick this off.
Well, I think one of my insights, if I could call it that, some people might call it an affectation, was that you really can't assess presidents completely without understanding how they resonated or not with their voters, the contemporaneous electorate. And so I tried to sort of crank that into my assessment and analysis of these various presidents. I'd say that in that realm, the index of greatness is the question of, are they a two-term president succeeded by their own party? In other words, they got elected, which is not easy to do. Even the bad presidents are impressive in that regard. They got reelected, which is even harder to do because it indicates that your performance in office is requited with eligibility for rehire. And then, if, and this is really hard, given the problems that can emerge over 8 years, if a president of your own party succeeds you, then that indicates that something significant has taken place. And I'd say that in the 20th century, the only two presidents who were elected twice and were succeeded by their own party were Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. And I consider them to be the two greatest presidents of the 20th century. Now, I will have to say, because some of your listeners will be saying, well, wait a minute, what about Teddy Roosevelt and what about Calvin Coolidge? True, they had two terms, or they had a partial term, a full term, and were succeeded by their own party, but they weren't elected twice.
Mm-hmm. And you also, in your book, talk about the great destiny, the leader of destiny presidents, and that's a slightly longer list, isn't it?
Well, it is a longer list. I have three criteria. The one I just described, a two-term president succeeded by his own party, number one. Number two, consistently rated as great in the polls of historians and academics that have emerged every few years since Arthur Schlesinger Sr. of Harvard pioneered this particular form of scholarship in 1948. And then thirdly, did they alter the political landscape of America and set the country upon a new course? And if they did those three things, then I put them in the circle of greatness. And there aren't very many who fit into that category. Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, T.R., F.D.R., and the jury's still out on Reagan, but I think that ultimately he's going to be there. He doesn't have the academics slobbering over him the way these other guys do, but I think he's going to over time.
Now, I can understand how relatively easy it would be to reach back into previous presidential elections and find the data on polling. How do you go about getting it from the historians when it comes to the professional historian perspective?
you know, it's really ragged. It's not a science. It's I'm not even sure it's an art form, but because I've been involved in these polls, and you know, those of us who study this thing, we know a lot about all the presidents, but I have to say, I just did a poll for C-SPAN, and I was asked to rate presidents in various categories, giving them a 1 to a 10. And there were some categories that I had to say to myself, Mary, do you think you really know enough about this? So I left a good number of them blank. So, it's hazy, but it's all we have for history's judgment. If you want history's judgment, you have to look at these polls. And I look at them en masse. I look at them as in terms of what the historians have been saying about these presidents since 1948 in these various polls. And there's been quite a few of them. So it's quite a body of data that we can look at.
The other thing that I think you discovered in your book is that you felt important to point out the fact that these leader of destiny presidents are pretty controversial in their own right, even somebody like Lincoln, but certainly Jefferson as a slave owner, Jackson as the guy who removed the Cherokees from Georgia and North Carolina. How do you deal with those who would say, well, now, wait a minute, I don't like the idea of destiny being attached to the slave owner's name?
Well, that's an excellent question, and that gets to the nub of a lot of controversy that's going on in America today, where we're experiencing kind of an assault on some of the leaders of our heritage. That's one of the reasons why I include that third element, which is how was he regarded contemporaneously by the electorate, because that tends to leaven a bit or reduce the significance of ex post facto sermonizing or moralizing about these various guys. The fact of the matter is that Jackson was an extremely significant president because he created this sort of populist concept that there was within the electorate a collective judgment, maybe even a collective wisdom, and that we need to listen to that. And up to that time, Jefferson was moving in that direction, but he didn't have the opportunity, or I think maybe he didn't have the boldness to push forward into that in the same way that Jackson did. So he's a seminal president.
You talk about the changing winds of history, and I think that's really a fascinating aspect of trying to judge a president, because obviously it can change over time. Tell us how that works, especially in regard to certain presidents. Truman comes to mind.
Well, I'll talk about Truman in a second, but the one example that I really like is President Grant, who in the historian polls was right down there near the bottom. He had scandals in his presidency. He didn't handle the scandals very well. He also was very controversial in his time with regard to Reconstruction. He was a hardliner on Reconstruction, and he used the power of the presidency to really put a thumb on the South as they sought to eliminate or reduce the rights of freed blacks. But recently there's been some scholarship that looks at that Reconstruction quite differently, whereas previously it was seen that these so-called radical Republicans in the Senate, who basically took over the government from the presidency, created all kinds of frictions and turmoil and set back the process of the country healing after the Civil War. But this new scholarship said, wait a minute, those guys were the civil rights workers, the civil rights activists of their time, and we should not dismiss them so avidly. So the result is that Grant's standing among the polls has gone up significantly, and guess who's has gone down? Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, who was very much against that kind of approach that Grant epitomized. And was considered kind of courageous by some of the historians in the 1920s and 30s, and now is totally discredited. So those things can happen. Truman's an interesting case because Harry Truman, a lot of people think that Harry Truman was viewed as a complete failure by history as soon as he left office and that his standing has increased. That's not entirely true. The polls, I mean, in 1948 was the first one, and then they came out after that. The polls indicate that Truman was regarded by historians as a very seminal president from the beginning. But he had a 23% approval rating when he left office, which is about as low as it gets. If you can't find 23% who are willing to say that they like what you're doing, you really need to hang it up, right? And so my thesis about Truman is that his first term was heroic, absolutely heroic. What he accomplished was amazing. His second term was really pretty ragged. He had economic dislocations. He had petty scandals involving his cronies and pals from Missouri. He had a war in Korea that he couldn't get out of and couldn't win and was stuck in. Those kinds of things really harm a president's standing with the American people, and that's why his standing was so low in the second term.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking with Robert Mary about his book, Where They Stand, an in-depth look at what he calls the Great White House Rating Game. Maybe this is a good time for you to comment on your book, A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk. Now, most Americans don't even know where he fits in the American list of presidents, if indeed they know anything about him. Why remember him, and where does he rank?
Well, that's why I wrote the book on Polk, because he was a president that was discredited, or he wasn't given his due in terms of his standing with the American people. Nobody knows him. He's considered to be in a category with Millard Fillmore or Franklin Pierce, which is not the case at all. James K. Polk was elected in 1844. He promised he would only serve one term as soon as he got the nomination. He served one term. He took America into the Mexican-American War. He cadged all kinds of territory as a result of that. He completed the process of bringing Texas into the Union. He negotiated almost to the point of threats of war with the Brits about Oregon Territory, where you are and where I spend time, and cadged more than half of the Oregon Territory, the half we didn't get, of course, being Canada and British Columbia, et cetera. So he was a very significant president. He also reduced tariffs, which was he was a low tariff man, a low tax man like Jackson, his protege, his mentor, and he created something called the Independent Treasury, which was kind of a forerunner to the Fed, designed to maintain currency stability. So he was a hugely consequential president, and he gets ranked in the historian polls, you know, 8th, 9th. Sometimes 10th, which is sort of near great, and I think that's valid. But he wasn't known to the American people, so I sought to reverse that a little bit, and maybe I had a small factor in that.
So does Grover Cleveland get a better shake these days than he did originally, given the fact that he was, what, a two-time failure?
I say that in the book. Because if he, you know, a president that's not succeeded by his own party or isn't reelected indicates that, at least in terms of the electorate's feelings, he's not a success. And he's the only two-time, one-term president. So no, I don't think so. I think that Grover Cleveland was a mild failure in both instances and didn't know where the country was going and therefore wasn't able to execute real leadership. But, you know, there have been historians, Alan Nevins being among them, who have suggested that he was among the really great presidents. I don't agree with that.
So who was the worst president?
Well, I always thought it was James Buchanan. I think he's also had the least character of all of our presidents. He lied to the American people upon assuming the office in his inaugural address. He assured the American people that he would abide by the Dred Scott decision, whatever it was. What he didn't tell the American people was that he knew what it was going to be, because he had had an inappropriate conversation with Roger Taney of the Supreme Court Chief Justice and knew what it was. So that was a completely phony and basically a lie to the American people. And that's kind of the way James Buchanan was. He was totally self-absorbed and always maneuvering and manipulating to his own benefit. When he was James Polk, Secretary of State, he was just a thorn in his side for 4 years. But I have to say, there are a lot of people who think that George W. Bush is going to come down as a significant presidential failure, because the economy basically fell apart on his watch, and he executed a war policy that turned out to be, I think one can say, maybe debatable, but I think it's highly supportable, a disaster.
Well, you know, that must be a very difficult thing to live with as an ex-president when you can't possibly avoid all of that chatter that's going on in your life. And but you didn't mention Warren Harding.
Well, because I think that Warren Harding gets a bad rap. I think that the person who gets the best rap, undeserved, is Woodrow Wilson, who took us into a war unnecessarily, and that was turned out to be significantly detrimental to the country. In the process of doing that, he trampled all over civil liberties. The economy just went into the tank. And then along comes Warren Harding, and Harding executes some very bold economic policies, particularly tax reductions after they had gone up significantly in the Wilson years. And within his second year in the presidency, he had a 14% GDP growth rate. Now, any president who can get a 14% GDP growth rate is not a failure in my mind, and he gets no credit for that. But I give him credit for that because I don't think that's very easy to accomplish. So, you know, I don't think he's a great president. I'm not even sure I'd call him a good president, but he wasn't in the sort of the bottom in my view.
You and I were talking about David Aaron Miller in his book, The End of Greatness, which we discussed here on this show a couple of months ago with the author. And one of the points he makes is that war plays such a great role in the greatness issue. How do you factor in war in your assessment of presidential greatness?
Well, taking the country to war is the most politically dangerous decision a president can make. There is no decision that is more politically dangerous, because if you win the war and you can win it decisively, your stock goes up hugely, both in terms of history and in terms of the eyes of the American people. But if you get yourself into a quagmire, as Lyndon Johnson did, and to some extent as George W. Bush did, and to a lesser extent, but not insignificantly, as James K. Polk did in the Mexican-American War, where it went on for 2 years, and he thought that if he could just conquer some territory into Mexico, they would sue for peace, and he would be able to get all this land that they really couldn't handle anyway, and he was willing to pay for it. But it didn't happen that way, and so his standing with the American people went down significantly. So, yes, wartime, I mean, there's a famous quote from William Jefferson Clinton, who said that if he had a war, he could have been seen as a much more consequential president. Yeah, perhaps. He could have been seen also as a Lyndon Johnson type of president, which is not so consequential, mm-hmm. except in a negative way.
Where's Clinton going to wind up in the presidential ranking business?
I think Clinton was a good president. He wasn't a great president, and I discuss in my book why I don't think so. I think that he husbanded political capital too cautiously, and he wasn't bold. And there were a lot of things that needed attention, and he wasn't willing to expend political capital to move on those things. I'd say the entitlement crisis, which was a crisis still then and still is. I would say Al-Qaeda, which needed some attention, and as we know now in retrospect. But he presided over peace, prosperity, and domestic tranquility, and those are the three basics. So I give him credit, and the American people is kind of funny. Such a rogue, and sometimes a reckless rogue, and yet he was so charming, and the American people just kind of accepted that.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Robert Mary, author of Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. So Dwight Eisenhower is a candidate I can remember back when I was a lot younger, adults around me talking about the fact that all he knew how to do is play golf, and that was the end of that. And in retrospect, his status has improved considerably, hasn't it?
He's one that the academic polls indicate that his standing has improved significantly in history. Yeah, he was sort of middling, right in the sort of middle ranks, and now he's up there in the 12, 11, 10, perhaps. And the famous phrase about him was the hidden hand presidency. and which is coined by an academic who wrote a lot about him by the name of Greenstein. And he talked about how Eisenhower managed to move events without doing so with a great deal of fanfare. But yet he managed to move them in the direction he wanted them to go. I just spent 3 years with William McKinley, and he's also one of these hidden hand strategists. And it makes it hard to bring a guy like that to life until you understand how he's operating. And then it sort of becomes sort of interesting about, well, how did he do that? You know, how did he manage to totally transform the policy from his predecessor with regard to bringing Hawaii into the United States? And he didn't have any fingerprints on it. He did somewhat, of course, but he just managed to nudge events in the favored direction constantly, kind of like a sheepdog, you know, moving the sheep where he wanted them to go. And ultimately, it all fell into place. And he never cared who got the credit, but he always got what he wanted.
Bob, when does the McKinley book hit the bookstores?
It's coming out in September. We're kind of excited, Simon Schuster and my editor there, Alice Mayhew, and I. And so we're hoping that maybe we can sort of elevate McKinley a bit, because I think he deserves a little elevation.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of the book?
It's called President McKinley, and the subtitle is Architect of the American Century. It's a very audacious subtitle. I think I make the case. I think I make the case that he really did set America on the course that became clear when Henry Luce famously said, and during in the middle of World War II, that we're entering the American century. So I try to make that case, and I suspect I might kick up some controversy among academics, but that's fine. We'll have some debate, and I think it'll be fun.
You know, I'd like to bring up a topic that I haven't heard discussed much in the presidential rating game, probably because it was never able to be discussed until Obama became president. But there are those who think that when it comes to Obama holding on to Congress in his first midterm election and his inability to move a legislative agenda, that there's a race factor that no American president ever had to deal with before. There was certainly a different Congress than Lyndon Johnson had to deal with in the bipartisan era, when you could actually go across the aisle and get Republicans to vote for Democratic initiatives. That died a few years ago. And I wonder how that's going to – is it even possible to somehow measure how that impacts presidential rankings when it comes to either polls or historians' perspectives?
I don't think it's possible, and I think that there's so many factors that come into play. You know, you get people like Chris Matthews on MSNBC talking about dog whistles and, you know, underlying racism of America. You know, I think that if that was the case, it's a little interesting that so many Americans, including Americans who subsequently voted for Donald Trump in the last election, voted for Obama, especially in 2008. So I just don't know, and I don't pretend to know. But I do know this. I think that when a president takes office with a minority, you know, if you're down in the you're below 50%, you have to understand how to husband your resources very, very carefully and expend political capital in ways that expand your political capital. Now, Nixon did this. And Nixon was elected in a time of extreme national conflict. And I've studied this, and he did it very, very deftly and very carefully. And he had to do some things in Vietnam that expended huge amounts of political capital in the process. But nevertheless, by the time he finished that first term, or even halfway through it, he had expanded his political capital. Now take Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was a 43% president or 44% president, same as Nixon. And he immediately came out of the gate and said, I'm going to repeal Reaganism. That was the unfortunate quote from the standpoint of his political standing, because the American people love Reagan. And he basically insulted the American people by saying, you guys were idiots, and I'm going to repeal everything that he did for you. And so the result was that he had his head handed to him in the mid midterm elections. He lost the Senate, he lost the House. Nixon, by contrast, he lost seats in the House. I probably lost seats in the Senate, I don't quite remember. But it wasn't as devastating as it was for Clinton. So Clinton, very, very wisely, I think brilliantly, changed course and took an approach that was designed to maintain his political capital. As I said earlier, I think he, once he had it, he could have expended it more and invested it more in some big initiatives that would have made him look bigger in history, but he chose not to do that. So I don't know about this Obama and the racial thing. We know that there's racial sentiments and racism in America. How deep is it? How much is it affecting people in the ballot box? Hard to say. And I don't think there's any way we can say.
At the conclusion of your book, and of course your book was published in 2012, Obama was still in his first term, you say, it does seem clear, after all, that the country is poised for a significant new direction within the foreseeable future. You must have had a crystal ball in front of you on that one. Was President Trump the significant new direction you foresaw?
Well, I think he was to a significant extent. I mean, I think that Obama missed a tremendous opportunity to forge a new brand of politics. Instead, he sort of defaulted back to the New Deal, Great Society, and that era is over. We're in a crisis of the old order. We're in a crisis of the status quo, in which the status quo no longer works. And the American people know it. Most politicians don't know it. This crazy guy, Trump, looked at various issues, trade, immigration, taxes, various others, and he sort of hit these notes. Now, the question is it possible to forge a new coalition out of that cluster of issues and that collection of dialectical political positions that he, I think, rather brilliantly calculated during the campaign? It really falls to what kind of a leader he is capable of being, and I'm not very sanguine about that.
Well, obviously, the first chance that we'll all have as a country to see just how the Trump presidency plays is the 2018 congressional elections, and I think it's fair to say right now the Republican Party is just confused, the Republican Party in Congress, that is, over what to do next, because this is a president that has the support of the base of that party to a large extent. And yet out in Seattle, there's a GOP rep, Reichert, who was a sheriff of King County and apparently pretty safely ensconced in Congress and in his Republican majority. And he's been very outspoken about Trump. But when you number those who have, it's like, I don't know, what, 10 or 12? So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think these people just don't want to get out front until they know. Yeah. They don't want to contribute to his failure before they know that he has got failure stamped all over him. And, you know, some people see it now. And, of course, his opposition sees it because that's what the opposition always does. They assume that the incumbent is an idiot and he's failing, and they thought that of Reagan because he had to steer America through a recession that was very deep in order to squeeze inflation out of the economy. But he did, and then the economy came roaring back, and he had these incredible growth rates and was reelected by a tremendous margin, almost 60%. So, you know, I don't think we know, but we certainly can see how he operates. And it's a little hard for me to see this operational style translating into overall 4-year term political success. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Time will tell. Bob Mary, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians by Robert W. Mary. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for the invitation.
Next week, Cy Montgomery, author of The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.